Well, good evening. For those of you who were here and recall from last time, the last time I got up here to do this, it was a Sunday night singing service, and there were about 30 seconds left in our scheduled hour at that point. So I want to say thank you to Rodney for giving me a chance to do this again with what's now considerably more time than 30 seconds. But that said, I'll still try to use it efficiently. The scripture reading that was read in your presence at the beginning of our worship this evening was Romans 12, 1 through 3. And Romans is a focus for our congregation for this quarter. It's the topic of our Sunday class and our Wednesday class in the auditorium. I understand there will be many lessons preached by Chuck and others on the book of Romans, and it ties into our theme that Rodney introduced this morning of more than conquerors. So I wanted to select something out of Romans for us to look at. And the part I want to focus on from that scripture that was read to us is right there in the middle of those three verses, verse 2 in Romans 12, and it says, "Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." Because Christianity, as we know, is a transformed life. We're transformed from the old man of sin and death into a newness of life. That's what Romans 6 tells us. It tells us that happens in baptism. That in baptism we follow Jesus into his death. And we follow him up out of the water into his resurrection. And that when we come out of the water, we come out of the water into a newness of life, and we begin living a transformed, a reborn life. And what's happening here in Romans 12 is it talks about this process of transformation and renewing of the mind, but it's continual because, unfortunately, we don't become completely transformed instantaneously. It requires a continual conforming of ourselves away from the world and to a life that's centered around worship. And so I want to call your attention to an example of the Old Testament, I think, where we see two examples of transformation from the inside out like this that have to do with thoughts and changing your life by renewing your mind. One example good, one bad, both from the same story. I'll introduce the story with this to give you a clue of what we're going to talk about. Imagine if you saw a headline in today's news or the newspaper, and it said, "Syrian general who had kidnapped an Israeli girl is healed by a high-ranking Israeli official." You might want to know what's going on. That would sound kind of interesting. It might sound unusual and unexpected. One, because we know Syrians and Israelis are enemies. In fact, for the better part of 3,000 years, they've been going at it. It's probably not hard to figure out. The story I want to talk about tonight has to do with Naaman. So if you would, go ahead and turn to 2 Kings chapter 5. And we'll look at the story of Naaman. And I want to call your attention, maybe, if you're like me, to some things that you haven't always noticed in this story about Naaman. Naaman's pretty familiar to all of us. And in fact, the first part of the story was very familiar to me, how he came to be healed, how he was surprised in the manner in which he was healed. It didn't fit what his expectations were and what lessons we might get out of that. But I want to focus tonight on what comes after that. But let's set the stage. So in this chapter, Naaman, of course, is a central figure. And who is he? Well, we find out that he's kind of a perplexed but very grateful Syrian general who, as the story tells us, he's discovered that there's a God in Israel who does things that his gods in Syria don't do and can't do. And his response to that is that he undergoes a transformation. He begins to change his mindset. Well, we know the story well. Verse 1 sets out for us who Naaman is. He's a great general. He has leprosy. I'll go ahead and read it because there's a few more specifics I want to call your attention to. It says, "Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper." So what do we learn about Naaman here? Well, he's a high-ranking general. In fact, his master is the king of Syria. He's well-regarded. The king believes him to be great and honorable. And he's a leper. Oh, and there's one more kind of surprising thing we find out about him, and that God has taken an interest in him, even though he doesn't know who God is. He has no knowledge of God. But God's taken an interest in him because we know this, because he's blessed him with grace, in that Naaman has been successful and victorious in his battles through the blessing of God. Well, we continue the story in verse 2 and 3, and this is how he starts to learn about exactly who this God is. So what happens is, he comes to find out that there's a prophet, a Jewish prophet, in Israel, Elisha, that can heal him. Well, how does he find this out? Let's look at verse 2 and 3. It says, "And the Syrians had gone out on raids, and they brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife. And then she said to her mistress, 'If only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy.'" So this whole thing starts because they've been raiding into Israel, and in fact they bring back this young girl captive. And even though she's been brought captive into Naaman's household, this might be kind of surprising, but she does a good thing for Naaman. She offers him a measure of kindness and grace, and she says, "You know, I see your leprosy. There's someone in my country who can do something about that. There's a God in my country that can do something about that." And so then we find out in the story that Naaman wants to go find out about this. So in verse 4 and 5, he goes to the king and he tells the king about it. And the king's reaction is, "This is great. This is fantastic. I've got my top general here. I really love this guy. He's great. He can be healed if we send him over to Israel. So you know what we're going to do?" he says. "I'm going to write a letter to the king in Israel. I'm going to send you there with a bunch of silver, a bunch of gold, and a lot of clothes. And you're going to go there in this grand royal procession, and you're going to ask to meet this man, this prophet, and you're going to seek out this healing." And so, of course, the way this is all set up, we find out what Naaman's expecting is sort of the royal treatment. He's coming here, one royal to another, expecting that this is going to get handled on those terms. It's kind of an entertaining bit in how the king of Israel receives it. He gets this letter and he thinks, "Oh no, this is terrible. This is horrible. This is not going to end well. It's going to end in fighting. The Syrians are powerful. People are going to die. This is not going to end well." But Elisha has different ideas. The king, he says, "This is terrible. I'm going to tear my clothes. This is a horrible thing." And in verse 8 it says, well, Elisha thought something differently. It says, "So it was when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent to the king saying, 'Why have you torn your clothes? Please, let this man come to me, and then he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel.'" Elisha says, "This is a good thing. Our enemies can learn about God. Let them come and find out." So this part, like I said, of the story, I think we know well, right? So Naaman comes up to Elisha now, and he comes up with his gold and his silver and his clothes and his horses and his chariots, and he comes up in sort of this grand procession, and he says, "All right, Elisha, come out, do your thing." but what do we know happens, right? So Elisha does something that Naaman doesn't like at first. He just sends a message out, sends a telegram or a messenger, and he comes out to him and he says, "Go dip in the Jordan River 7 times, you'll be healed." And well, we know Naaman's reaction to this, right? He's furious. He rants, he loses his temper. Why? Because this doesn't fit his idea of how this was going to happen. He tells us exactly what he thought was going to happen in verse 11. He said, "He will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy." He thought there were going to be some pomp and circumstance here, some dramatic, something befitting the royalty involved here. But fortunately for Naaman, even though that's his initial reaction, like all along in the story, he's got some wise people looking out for him, some people that care about him, like this young Jewish girl in his household, like God who's bestowed favor on him. He has servants that are with him that help him make some sense of this. And so Naaman leaves his pride there on the banks of the Jordan. We know he gets washed and then he's healed. And then to me, the story gets pretty interesting in a way I haven't necessarily always thought of. What happens after he's healed? And in fact, we learn a story about two men that change in very different ways after Naaman's healed. But let's deal with Naaman first. What's the change that happens in his life? Well, a new reality has come crashing into his life with this healing. And in response to that, what we'll find out is he begins to transform and change his thinking. He renews his mind so that he can come to terms with what has just happened. Well, what's happened? He has a new belief about God that he didn't have before. He tells us this in verse 15. Notice in verse 15 he goes back to Elisha this time, but he doesn't have the horses and chariots and he just stands before him. And what does he tell him? He says, "Indeed, now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel." This is it. His whole worldview has changed. And he comes back to Elisha and he says, "Now I know." This is incredible. This is transformative. This changes everything, if you're Naaman. He says, "Now I know there's no God in all the earth except in Israel." There's only one God. This is completely different from what he believed before. Because until now, he's always worshipped his local god in Syria, Rimmon, or the Baals. But now he knows something about Rimmon. While Rimmon may look spectacular and awe-inspiring, sitting in the shrine back in Syria, Rimmon's not actually good for anything when it comes to leprosy. Rimmon can't do a thing. But his enemy, Israel, well, they worship a god who's invisible. You can't see him. There's no statue in a temple or a sanctuary. But this god, he's come to find out, beats Rimmon hands down in healing and dealing with leprosy. It's no contest. And this god has now touched Naaman. He says, "Now I know." It's changed everything for him. So he begins to try to change his life to deal with this new belief. And he doesn't do it exactly right from the get-go. I mean, notice in verse 15, his first reaction is, "Please, take this gift. I brought this gold and silver and clothes. Take it. Let me give you this gift in exchange." And of course, Elisha turns him down. He says, "No, I won't take it. I can't take it." And of course, there's some lessons there about God's grace, and that God's grace isn't a gift to be bought or purchased, right? It's a gift. It's unmerited favor. It's not something Naaman can give a gift in exchange for. Naaman's learning that. But now I want you to notice that he doesn't stop there in trying to change and transform his life. He does two things. He does two things, I think, that show his determination to get his thinking turned around and get his thinking worked out. So number one, the first thing he does is he works out a way that he's going to worship this God that he's come to know, even if it's going to be a little bit awkward for him to do that. And then the second thing he does is he starts to examine his own life and look at the complications in his life and see where he's going to have trouble, where there's going to be a clash between his new belief in this God and his behavior in his past life. And he's working out how he's going to deal with this. Let's take the first one first, because here he starts to work out how he's going to worship God. Look in verse 17. After being refused of the gifts, Naaman says, "Then If you won't take the gifts, will you give me two mule loads of earth? For your servant will no longer offer either burnt offering or sacrifice to other gods, but only to the Lord. This is actually a little comical to think about, because his response of how he's going to worship God is, give me two cartloads of dirt to take back to Syria. You see, Naaman's thinking still isn't quite all the way there. He's still fixated on the idea that gods are territorial gods. But he's determined that now that he's found the only God that matters, he's going to worship this God on his own turf. Right? So that's why he says, give me the dirt to bring back so that I can worship God where he is. Naaman's determined he's going to go back. He's not going to worship Rimmon anymore. He's not going to worship other gods. He's only going to worship the God of Israel. And in his mind, he needs the dirt to do this. He hasn't yet worked out the next step, that if the God of Israel is the only true God, then he's God in Syria too. He'll get there, I think. But he hasn't gotten there yet. The second thing he does, I think, maybe is even a little more fascinating. He begins to take a look at his own life and his own habits and practices and how that fits in with his newfound belief. And he says in verse 18, he says, "Yet in this thing may the Lord pardon your servant. When my master goes into the temple of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, when I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord please pardon your servant in this thing." What's he saying? He's already said he's not going to worship Rimmon. None of that's involved here. He's worshiping God and God alone. But he says, you know, I do have this problem with people I deal with every day. One of them happens to be my master. And oh, by the way, he's the king. So that puts me in a really tight spot. And the king expects me to take him into the temple from time to time when he worships Rimmon. He's not saying I'm going to worship Rimmon myself, but he has to take the king in there. And he says, well, you know, the king's an old man, and he has to lean on my arm for support. And so when the king bows down to worship, well, I'm going to have to bow down too, because he might fall over if I don't let him hold onto my arm and bow down with him. I mean, I think that's the gist of what he's saying here. And his question to Elisha is, what else can I do about this? I know this might be wrong, and I know I'm probably going to stumble, and I'm asking you for pardon, for forgiveness. So Naaman here, he's caught between his old life and his new life, and he's caught between his realization of what God is, a living, loving, healing God, and the reality of his past sinful, sort of muddled, already compromised life. And to emerge from this, he's got to reshape the way he thinks about things. And that's what he's starting to do here. That's what I want us to see. So you might ask, well, you know, wait a second. Isn't he already compromising on his faith? Here we are, hour one. He's already giving in on some things. Shouldn't he be like Daniel in Babylon and tell the king, just take a hike? I'm not going in there with you. I'm going to open my window when it's time to pray towards Jerusalem, and I'm going to pray to the God of Israel. Maybe. But there's a realization here that it takes a while to learn to be Daniel. You don't become a Daniel right away. Naaman, I think, is headed there. At some point in his life, he may have to make a stand like that. But he's on his way. And at least he has a self-realization to know what his problem area is. And he's asking for forgiveness from God. He's bringing it to God and to Elisha. And he's asking for forgiveness. And he's almost certainly asking for help too. And remember, he's got help, including this girl who sent him on this journey to begin with back in his household. And God has helped him. Before he even knew who God was, God was helping him. So what's Elisha's response? Maybe this is surprising, but maybe it's not. Elisha says, go in peace. So what does this tell us? I think it tells us that there's room for mercy and for patience and for forgiveness. But it depends on our mindset. It depends on whether we're transformed, whether we're renewing on our minds. Where are we headed? And I'll tell you that these actions he's taken, I think they fit all the elements you see in Romans 12, 1 and 2. It says, present yourself a living sacrifice. That's why he carried the dirt back. He was incorporating that sacrifice into his life. He was going to sacrifice the one true God back in his home. He wasn't hiding his newfound religion. He was going to go back and sacrifice to God and not to Rimmon. People were going to see this and they were going to wonder what the dirt was for. He incorporated this into his life. He made his life a life of worship to the one true God and sacrifice. Romans says, don't be conformed to the world, but be transformed by a renewing of the mind. I think that's what he's doing here when he's trying to come to terms with, well, what do I deal with? How do I deal with the times when I have to go into the temple of Rimmon? He's trying not to conform to Rimmon. He's already said, I'm not going to worship Rimmon. He's coming to terms with how he can conform to God and not his past life. And then in verse 20, we get Gehazi. But Gehazi, that's not a good start for Gehazi. This has already worked out well for Naaman. Elisha told him, go in peace. And now here we hear, but Gehazi. So this is going to be kind of a tragic mirror image of what just happened with Naaman. Who's Gehazi? Well, he's Elisha's servant. He's been by his side. He's seen God working miracles through Elisha. He's seen all the splendor and glory of God up close and personal. But when Naaman's healed, a change comes about, and Gehazi's thinking too. In verse 20, we find out that he starts to see Naaman as an enemy, to be squeezed for money, taken for everything he's worth, not as a child of God to be healed. He says in verse 20, but Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, said, look, my master has spared Naaman the Syrian while not receiving from his hands what he brought, but as the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him. So he's determined he's going to get something back from Naaman. This leads directly to Eli, because he finally catches up to him in verse 22, and he tells Naaman a story about two young men who need money and clothes, and that Elisha needs money for these two young men who've come to visit in his country. Naaman says, okay, and he gives him the money. Well, this leads to even more problems for Gehazi, because he gets back and now he's got to hide the money. He knows it was wrong. So in verse 23 and 24, he hides the money, which leads to an even bigger lie, because his master now comes and says, where have you been? In verse 25, it says, Elisha said to him, where did you go, Gehazi? And he said, your servant didn't go anywhere. I was reading some of the other translations, and one of the ones I read was actually the old King James. And the phrasing kind of puts a smile on my face when I read it, because it says, Elisha says to him, whence comes thou, Gehazi? And Gehazi says, I went no whither. So I didn't go no whither. And Elisha says, oh, you withered. You went wither for sure. And you just see this all come crashing down on Gehazi. Naaman, who's been cleaned, been cleansed, suddenly Gehazi, he's not clean. He's got, his hands are dirty with sin. And so the leprosy falls on him. And Elisha responds to him, no, you're certainly not clean, and your compromise is not anything like Naaman's. Your predicament is nothing like his. You're not renewing your mind, Gehazi. Instead of renewing his mind, what's happened is he's given his mind over to passion and to lust and to greed. Gehazi's actions are deceitful, not honest. He tries to hide what he's done, while Naaman is honest about it. He knows where his problems are. He's honestly taking it to God and saying, How do I deal with this? Can you help me? He's seeking forgiveness. The two stories make clear that what happens with Naaman isn't that God doesn't care about sin. He sure does, because he sure cared about Gehazi's sin. But God cares also about what path we're on and the transformation we're undergoing and whether or not we're renewing our minds. I want to make a comment just very briefly about something from this morning's service. Our brother Matthew had an excellent reading from 1 Corinthians before the Lord's Supper. And he stressed the idea that about unity, and that, you know, if we fail to have unity, we might be failing in our worship. And that was good to hear. I'm glad that was said in this church, and thank you for doing that. Unity is certainly something this church needs to care about, but if there's a small bit of good news, is that's a pretty common problem. Obviously, the Corinthians had to worry about it. The churches in Rome had to worry about it. And maybe from time to time, we might get frustrated and it might seem like, well, things are out of our control. I can't bring about unity. But one of the surprising things about these verses in Romans 12, 1 and 2, when it's talking about transforming our own individual minds by renewing our own individual hearts, is it leads right into one of the greatest passages in the Bible about unity. So how can transforming ourselves personally bring about unity? Well, keep in mind what the transformation is, right? We are transforming ourselves into the likeness of Christ. It begins with our baptism. We die with Him. We're raised with Him. We start to become like Him. And as we become more like Him, we're becoming more like other people that are also becoming like Him. We've become more like each other. And so this transformation helps bring about unity. And one of the things I didn't realize about this story about Naaman is the same thing happened with Naaman's transformation. It helped bring about a unity. Because the story doesn't end right here with Gehazi's downfall. This story actually continues. It picks up in chapter 6. There's sort of a brief interlude there where Elisha does this miracle with the floating axe head. But then in verse 8, we're back in Syria, and the king of Syria is there. The king who Naaman works closely with. We're back in Syria where Naaman's brought his dirt, and he's worshiping the God of Israel. And this king has decided he's going to continue to make war against Israel. And he starts to learn about the God of Israel, right? We're not going to go through the whole story, but he comes to find out there is a prophet in Israel, Elisha, and he's going to cause a lot of problems for me. And then in the end, he's going to show a great deal of mercy to me. And when you get down to verse 23, it says, "So the bands of Syrian raiders came no more into the land of Israel." That's the end of the story. That's where it stops. Eventually, the king comes to realize there is a God in Israel, and he's got something that we don't have. And we're calling off these raids. It's all over. And who do you think might have been in his ear the entire time but Naaman? There is a hidden hero in this story, by the way. Because in verse 23 of chapter 6, it talks about how the raids are over. The story begins with the raids in chapter 5, verse 2. It says, "The Syrians had gone out on raids and brought back a captive young girl from the land of Israel. And she waited on Naaman's wife." This whole series of events got started because this young girl from Israel, while she was brought captive into Naaman's house, refused to conform herself to her captors, refused to conform herself to the world of Syria and Rimmon, and clung to her identity as a child of God. And she even offered this small measure of grace and favor to Naaman and said, "You can be healed." And she said, and when she did that, she set the whole thing in motion. And the end result was Israel and Syria, who were formerly raiding each other and at war, they've come to peace. And at the center of this whole story is Naaman's transformation. So our own transformations can bring about unity. And that's something to remember. We haven't talked much about baptism, but Romans 6 tells us that this transformation and this renewing of our mind starts with baptism. Romans 6, verse 3 says, "Or do you not know that as many of us as were baptized in Christ Jesus were baptized into His death? Therefore we were buried with Him through baptism into death. Just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we should also walk in newness of life." That's the transformation we're all after. Walking in the newness of life. Romans 6 also deals with the fact that there's going to be some stumbling blocks on the way. We're going to have to deal with sin as we go. Because in verse 11 it says, "Likewise also, reckon yourselves to be dead indeed to sin, but alive to God in Christ Jesus our Lord." What's reckon mean? Reckon means calculate it. Figure it out. Figure out what this means in your own life. How are you going to live a life where you're in fact dead to sin and alive to God? How are you going to deal with the sins that invariably crop up in your life? So tonight, if you need to start that transformation, it starts with baptism. If you haven't done that, tonight is a good night to do it. If you have, and you're caught up in stumbling blocks and sins in your life, and you need help getting past those, continuing on your journey of transformation, renewing your mind, you can come and, like Naaman, you can ask for forgiveness in those things. You can do those tonight as we stand and sing.